This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have as my featured guest for the first hour a brilliant mathematician, statistician, and analyst of voter fraud in the United States. He has a book on Amazon.com, Proving Election Fraud, the image for which you'll see momentarily, a new book that's an easier read. His name is Richard Jarnin. Richard, welcome to The Real Deal.
Thank you, Jim. It's always a pleasure.
I'm so glad to have you here. Chance, if you show the first slide, please. Richard has a book. It's a big book. It's a heavy book. He's done a lot of work in math and statistics, and I regard him as completely brilliant. In fact, in the second slide, you'll see that he and I collaborated on an article about how Scott Walker cheated to gain his election and re-election, which Richard will discuss. Chance, could I have the second slide? Yeah. Richard, would you believe I got on to a couple of shows here in Madison and even had this article published in the Cap Times, but no one has picked up on it. I'm really shocked by this. I was on one show with a fellow named Mitch Hank, who said to a guest he had who mentioned that they'd published something by me in the Cap Times, that the story didn't have legs. I can't imagine what story would have legs. If this story doesn't have legs, none of them have legs. And I was also featured by two guys who have a very lively discussion. They're called the Devil's Advocates, and they talked about it too, but it was only for about half an hour. And I can't believe the difficulty I have people understanding that the state legislature is rewriting Wisconsin's laws. Right now, they're changing the water laws to privatize water. I mean, it's catastrophic, and they're doing it in the confidence that because they control the voting machines, they're at no risk of being turned out of office.
Yeah, Jim, I don't know too much of the politics in Wisconsin, but I do know the numbers, and I started looking at Wisconsin back in 2011, the Supreme Court election, and that's really what got started on Facebook. And I've been following every election since. There have been three stolen elections by Walker. Feingold was elected, and they stole it from him. I've done analysis on that. As far as not getting traction, I believe a lot of people are trying very hard in Wisconsin, but they can't get anywhere with the system they have in operation. It's but there's some really good activists there, but the media controls everything, not only in Wisconsin but all over, and that's the source of the problem, obviously.
I'm so glad to have you here to explain the general principles and techniques for understanding what's going on. We might begin with slide number three. Richard, let me turn it over to you.
Okay. In the first slide, I basically give an overview of some of the basic points. I believe that mathematics is the tool that has to be used. Anecdotal evidence is one thing. Mathematical proof is something else. In the course of my experience since 2001, 2002, working on models, forecasting, and post-election models. I've done a very, very thorough analysis and probably have more data than anybody else in the universe. I mean, I put it all together, all the exit polls, unadjusted, recorded votes, done the analysis, used the appropriate calculations to calculate the margins of error. And I've created a number of models which are all in confirmation. First is a true vote model where I use plausible vote shares of estimated returning voters. That is what I used to prove the 2004 election was stolen. And we're going to see a lot about 2004 because that is really the poster child of election fraud. The work that I've done there, I've carried over into other elections, presidential, senatorial, gubernatorial. So that's key. Then I've done recently, and you are aware of the cumulative vote share analysis, which is another approach. I wasn't the first one to do this, but I've done more downloading of data than anybody, in looking at especially the 2014 governor elections, the Walker elections, and basically that's another approach which uses actual precinct voting data. Then, of course, there's a voter turnout model, which is very simple. The keynote here is that the exit polls are adjusted to force the match the recorded vote. And if you look at the registered voter turnout, registered voters in each of the states, the percentage differs often from the exit polls party ID. And I show where, by using the registered voters percentages, the numbers come out more favorable for the Democrat.
Richard, it's just shocking to me that they would adjust the exit polls, which in some countries in Europe, for example, are used to determine the winners and the losers in order to conform to the tabulated vote totals. That's a disgrace.
Yeah, it's a disgrace, but the good thing is we use that against them. It's what they call a two-way sword. They use it. They thought they wouldn't get caught, but they're getting caught by their own numbers because the numbers they're using are mathematically impossible and in the final election polls, which have been adjusted. And that's really the keynote of my proof of fraud in 2004, 1968, 1988, and 1992, even though Clinton won, it was almost, there was 119% turnout of Bush voters, which is of course impossible. So they are matching to the recorded vote. They have no viable explanation. Scientifically, statistically, there's no excuse and nobody calls them out on it. I've been doing it for over 10 years and it doesn't seem to get through. People, you know, this stuff is fairly complicated to the extent that you really have to have an understanding of the numbers of the actual exit poll, state and national, and the recorded vote and the discrepancies. So I've determined it's now proof beyond any doubt that just like you can't have a magic bullet, it's anatomically impossible. It's anatomically impossible for 52 million Bush voters from 2000 to return to vote in 2004 when he only had 50 million voters in 2000. But the exit poll wants you to believe that there are effectively 5 million phantom Bush voters. Okay? And so it's mathematically proven as far as I'm concerned, and nobody's ever been able to refute that. So adjusting the exit polls to me is the key. Not only the exit polls, but the pre-election polls are biased too, because what they do is they eliminate likely voters, new voters who are mostly Democratic. So what you have is they adjust the polls coming in. They know the recorded vote is going to be bogus And so they adjust the vote polls coming in and predict, usually pretty accurately, the recorded vote, which, of course, is bogus. The other thing is that, you know, as we said, they always force the exit polls to match the recorded vote. The media-funded pollsters always assume zero fraud. Unadjusted polls are not for public viewing. And in 2012, just 31 states were exit polled. And basically, the problems really became obvious in 2002 when they installed all the touch screens and they went to voting machines that are totally manipulative. And so it's the problem's worse than ever.
And unverifiable.
Unverifiable.
So you can't even do a recount with these machines, Richard, which means to me that they're not even constitutional, because if you have a contested election, there's no way to resolve it.
And that's true. And you would think the Democrats would have done something, because they're always on the short end of the stick. And when way back in 2004, Kerry conceded right away. He disappointed a lot of Democrats. He won that election by nearly 10 million votes, but Bush won the recorded vote by 3 million, so figure it out. So the fact that Democrats haven't done anything caused me to move from the Democratic Party. To me, in many ways, the Republicans have to cheat to win.
Yes.
At least I give them credit. They're to this extent, it's the only way they can win, so they know they have to cheat. The Democrats, on the other hand, let them cheat, because we want to maintain the myth of a 50-50 electorate. That's the key. We always want to maintain that every election is close, just like Hillary and Bernie Sanders. They're not close. The Democrats have a built-in, I would say, 10% real vote margin on the Republicans. And I show that in my model. And based on the existing data for over the last 20 years, and we'll get to that in future slides. Maybe we go to the next one.
Slide 4. Yeah, thanks, Jess.
Okay. This is a little complicated, but I want people to understand the gist without worrying about how I came up with the numbers and probabilities. The Democrats, in 1988 to 2008, won the presidential recorded vote by an average of 48% to 46%, six elections. But they won the state and national unadjusted exit polls by 52% to 42%. So you've got an 8% discrepancy in margin. Now, that is beyond the pale. It is, you know, but I don't stop there. I mean, I calculate the probability of that. But here's the key. There were 274 state exit polls, which exceeded the 135 of 274, virtually half of the state presidential exit polls exceeded the margin of error. You would only expect 14 at the 95 percentile rate. But of 135, 131 moved from the exit poll in favor of the Republican. Well, I calculated the probability of that using a Poisson distribution. And so what I have here is a table which shows what the probabilities are, assuming different number of polls exceeding the margin of error. And we know that 135 did, but I'm showing what the probability would be if 112 did, or if 81 did. As you increase the margin of error, the probability will go up. But at the standard 30% cluster factor, which is applies to exit polling, we have a 3.6% average margin of error. The probability is one about e to the minus 83. That's 83 zeros before the one. So that, you know, is zero, right? It's worse than zero. And then even if you take it all the way down and expand the margin of error to 5.5%, you still have e to the minus 35, which is one in a trillion, trillion, trillion that you would get these results. that 81 polls would exceed the margin of error. In fact, 135 did. So,
Richard, I suspect that the audience will understand more clearly when you talk about specific cases, Wisconsin being among them.
Yeah, well, let's go to the next slide, and I'll try to clarify it. Okay, I want to show what I'm showing here is getting back to the exit polls historically from 1972 to 2008. In order to force the exit polls to match the vote, which is standard operating procedure, they had to adjust all the exit poll crosstab categories. And I'm showing here the percentages of voters returning, Republican, Bush voters, or Nixon voters that were required to match the vote. In 2004, as I mentioned before, the exit poll indicated that 52.6 million of the 2004 voters were returning Bush 2000 voters, but he had just 50.5 million votes in 2000. Approximately 2 million died based on 1% annual mortality. Therefore, at most, 48.5 million could have returned to vote in 2004. But the national exit poll indicated 52.6 million returned. In other words, there had to be 110% turnout of living Bush 2000 voters. It's impossible. Okay?
So there were just in case there's doubt in anyone's mind, 100% is all there is. So if it's higher than 100%, it ain't possible.
Exactly. And you won't even get 100% because a certain small percentage will not return to vote.
Sure.
So even assuming 97% of Bush voters, 2000 voters returned, simple arithmetic shows that there were at least 5.5 million phantom Bush voters.
That was their edge. Carl Rove talked about creating their own reality. I think this is an example, Richard.
Well, you would think after it's 2004, by this time already, you would think that people would be focusing on this very, very powerful smoking gun. But they don't. The media never talks about it.
That's the key. The media never talks about it.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the next one. Because we've got a few here to cover. But
right.
Okay. Here I show, like, we look at the 2000 election, which, of course, the media claims that Gore won the popular vote by 540,000 votes and lost the electoral vote by three votes. And the media myth is that the 2000 election was close. It wasn't close. Gore won the recorded vote by half a million, but he did much better than that. He won the unadjusted state exit polls by at least 5 million votes. He won the Florida exit poll by 10%. There's a 97% probability he won Florida by at least 200,000 votes. But Bush got the one Florida, stole it, and they claim he won it by 537 votes. He lost it by 200,000 votes.
And this is so significant, Richard, because this was the election that put Bush and Cheney into the White House that brought us 9/11, the War on Terror, the Department of Homeland Security, the Patriot Act, transformed America in a fundamental way to become a quasi-fascist state. And I'm sorry to say, things are getting worse.
Exactly. And I'll never forget when it happened. But I had no idea that there was such a disparity because you never got to see the unadjusted exit polls. I got to see them years later. One in 2010, I came across them on the University of Connecticut site. Anybody could look at them those days. Now you can't look at them unless you have special permission. Anyway,
isn't that ridiculous, Richard? In a democracy, that you can't even see vote totals or various indicators thereof.
Exactly.
In a democracy.
Exactly.
What a mockery.
Okay. Well, I've got them at least through 2008. I've got them, and every election, I'm showing the true vote compared to the recorded vote, and it's the biggest one, the biggest discrepancy of all. We'll get to. Is Obama 2008. He won that election by a minimum of 23 million votes, but they have them down to winning 9.5 million recorded. I'll show that later.
Okay.
Okay. Let's, and what I'm showing here is just basically the, a model which shows based on a turnout of 96 voters that Gore won according to the state exit poll aggregate by about 50 to 45%. Okay, next slide. Okay, this I put in because it's kind of a sexy little graph. When I first started doing this stuff, I really wasn't working on exit polls in 2004. I was doing forecasting, and I was using, I have to take credit for this. I was using the Monte Carlo simulation, and I swear that I never saw this before for election, for calculating the probability of winning the electoral vote. It just came to me that why not apply a simulation to forecast the electoral vote and the probability. And as turned out, it was 5,000 simulated election trials. I had Kerry winning by 51 to 47%. That's 5 million votes. Expected electoral votes 337 with a 98% win probability. What I'm showing here is the histogram, frequency histogram of electoral votes based on, you know, the number. We got 5,000 simulated elections. So you can see the big bar in the middle is around 335. So that's your normal. Basically, it's like a normal distribution curve in a way, cumulative distribution. But of course, the national exit poll, which you saw at the New York Times and CNN, gave you this little thing here, the gender vote. They matched it to the recorded vote. They said Kerry had 48.27% and Bush had 50.7. Well, we'll go to the next slide. We'll take another closer look at that. So that's how what they do. They also do the same thing with the question of how did you vote in the prior election in 2000. Again, they forced to match the recorded vote. Checked 110% turnout for Bush. I got the numbers in there which are exactly the national exit poll numbers, recorded, adjusted. Now, what I did was I took the unadjusted numbers and applied essentially the same vote shares, and we see that Kerry was a 51.8 to 46.8% winner, which is pretty much close to what I had forecast in my Monte Carlo simulation. In the true vote model, he actually did better. I have him at 53.6%, winning by nearly 11 million votes. True vote model, the key here is I get a feasible returning voter mix, prior election, and I apply the same vote shares, and I come up with what I call the true vote. And so anybody looking at this, they can get at these slides, this information on my website. Okay, on my blog. All right, next slide. All right, this is a little esoteric. I put this in. I ran into some very sophisticated naysayers, very smart. One came from England, another one was right here in New York State, which constantly tried to say that there was no fraud in 2004. I got into endless arguments, debates, 2005, 2006, with these naysayers. One argument that they used, and it was a little hard for me to try to explain it clearly, but they said there should be no slope when you compare the swing in the vote from 2000 to the exit poll shift, that there should be that a flat line indicates no fraud. So that's what they showed in their graph. I'm showing a downward sloping line. The fallacy that they used was that they were using recorded votes against the exit polls rather than the true vote. So they had built-in bias. So they were using invalid data to come up with their argument. I proved that, and this was called swing versus redshift. I proved that there was indeed a correlation between the redshift, the exit polls, and vote swing from 2000-2004. So this graph just shows what I came up with. Now, I'd like to, can I click on this? Will it work?
No.
Okay. Okay, well, it's in there. I have the 1988-2008 state and national true vote model. Very simple to use. It's key in the election year, 1992, and then you key in the state that you want to look at, or you want to look at the national vote. You type in the code, and boom, it'll give you the true vote versus the recorded vote in a matrix table like you saw before. Okay, next slide. Okay, another thing. Again, I'm focusing on 2004 because there's a lot to learn from that. They called it the Bush urban legend. Now, this actually applies to the Walker elections and all the gubernatorial elections we're going to talk about. There was a myth that in 2004, Bush improved over his 2000 vote in Democratic urban locations, while he actually declined in rural Republican areas. Makes no sense. Totally counterintuitive. An article by Michael Collins, who I associated with, produced this article called The Bush Urban Legend. And so I'm showing a couple of graphs here. Bush.
Especially for background knowledge that urban centers tend to be heavily Democratic and rural areas heavily Republican.
Sure.
So if he was losing in rural areas, it would make no sense at all that he'd be increasing his vote in urban.
Well, that's exactly what happened. His vote share dropped in rural areas, but it went up in suburban and big cities. In fact, I show at the bottom here, I show 15 top New York counties, including five boroughs. And you see the big red bars. That represents Bush's gain. The blue bars represent Kerry's gain. So Kerry, we know, did better than Gore. According to the recorded vote numbers, Bush improved New York City, a Democratic bastion. So that just illustrates that. Totally.
That's about as absurd as it gets in politics.
What's that?
That's about as absurd as it gets in politics.
Absolutely. And that's what we're running into now with the cumulative vote shares that you wrote the article about. Okay, next slide. Okay, in 2008, now this people will find of interest because nobody knows about it. Obama won the recorded vote solid by 9.5 million votes. However, the national exit poll, unadjusted, nearly 18,000 respondents, showed that he had 61% of the vote, 24% margin, which meant that if this was really his vote, he won by 30 million votes, not 9.5 million.
So now, the Republicans were suppressing it because they didn't want him to feel as though he had a greater mandate from the public.
Yeah, well, that's the national. But then I also look at the states individually and aggregate. In the states, he had 58% weighted average aggregate, which means he won by 23 million votes. So we have two different sets of polls. We have the national exit poll. We have the state, 50 state exit polls, and they confirm each other. And so what I'm showing here is the adjusted national exit poll, the final numbers, which shows that he had 52.9%. In reality, he had anywhere from 58 to 61%. Big, big, big fraud. People say big joke is, well, Obama stole the election. He had 100% votes in some precincts. I said, sure he did. Why is that surprising? You have black precincts and 100% of them voted for Obama. What's so hard to believe? Of course he had. Anyway, so much for Obama's landslides. All right, next slide.
Obama actually had a landslide, but it was misrepresented in the press and by other sources, authoritative, assumed to be authoritative, that misreported what actually happened.
Exactly. Now, they, you know, the fact is that in 2008, there were 13 million votes switched from Obama. The marginal difference was 13 million, which is exactly the difference we had in the 2004 election, where Kerry won by 10 million, but lost the recorded vote by 3. So the same mechanism they had was applied in 2008. 13
million vote buffer.
Yeah. 13 million vote differential in both elections. Okay, now let's get to Wisconsin. I see we're about halfway through. We're doing all right. Feingold versus Johnson. And Milwaukee County is the poster child for the cumulative vote shares. It shows up in every Wisconsin statewide election.
Milwaukee County, for the benefit of those looking on, is a bastion of Democratic support. Milwaukee County, a bastion of Democratic support.
Right. What this graph shows is cumulative votes. We have over 300,000 votes in Milwaukee County. Now, when it first started out, let's say after the first 60,000, from small to large precincts, first 60,000 votes, Feingold had 75%. But he ended up with about 66% in the final. So his votes came, vote shares dropped, Johnson's vote shares went up, and that's over, you know, that we're talking about a lot of votes here. Milwaukee County, by far the biggest county. But here's another one to look at. This is the second worst county in Wisconsin, Racine. Milwaukee County had 61,000 Feingold votes flipped to Johnson. 61,000. In Racine, which is smaller, you had 19,000 votes flipping from Feingold to Johnson. Again, this is an estimate. I'm not saying it's exact. Look at the graph. Look where Feingold was after the first 8,000 votes, and they cross right about at the 42,000 vote mark. A tremendous change. Okay?
So the more votes that were cast, again, the greater the percentage that went to Johnson.
Exactly. The more votes, again, we're going from the smaller precincts to the larger precincts, and we're accumulating the sum as we go along. So we start off at the smallest precinct, go to the next precinct, add the votes, go to the third precinct, add to the total, previous total, all the way down to the biggest precinct, or the biggest precinct in a given county, in a county. So we're looking at, basically we're looking at counties, but we're looking at precincts within the counties. And theoretically, in a fair election, the vote, the line should be somewhat parallel. You should not have a movement. In fact, if anything, the Democratic vote should slightly increase. But we're seeing just the opposite here. I mean, these are Democratic counties. All right, let's go to the next slide. Here's the Wisconsin Walker recall. Again, the same story. What do we have here? We have Kenosha County, which had 11% were DRE of touchscreens. And then we have Milwaukee County, where it's virtually all optical scanners. No paper ballots.
You know, Richard, I have a friend who actually has a degree in mathematics from University of Wisconsin-Madison who told me it's impossible for vote fraud to occur in Wisconsin.
I don't know. What can I say, Jim? It's impossible. Yeah, all the vote, every election is fair and square. That's when you look at the logic, it's very simple. I know just how to go after these naysayers. I said, you don't believe the exit polls? Okay, then you must believe the elections are fair. You think there's no election fraud? Well, you're an idiot. Okay? On the other hand, if you feel there's election fraud, then you got to believe the exit polls, because they illustrate the election fraud. So you got to have, you can't have it both ways. Either you want to look like an idiot and say there's no such thing and that the exit polls are wrong, or you a logical obverse of that would be, yeah, there is fraud, and the exit polls show them to be not only exit polls, all these other, this has nothing to do with exit polls here. This is just the pure votes, which is the beauty of this. They can't give me an argument about exit polls. I'm dealing with the actual recorded votes. Okay? And this illustrates that they've been flipped. All right, let's go to the next slide.
It's just embarrassing to me, Richard, that even the most sophisticated commentators in Wisconsin don't understand what's happened to the state.
Yeah. Well, everybody in the media, they're either willfully ignorant or they're just plain stupid. I don't know what else to say.
Corrupt.
Never heard, you know, I was watching the other night. I never watch media anymore on TV, MSNBC. I can't stand it. But I'm watching the Iowa caucus. So I see these same crew. They have lifetime jobs. They've been there for 30 years saying the same crap, never mentioning the fraud word. To them, every election is pure and clear that these things happen. Yeah, the late votes come in. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, so they've been giving you the same bull for the last 30 years. I mean, what can I say? Now, let's get back to the, in this graph, I'm showing the the movement in the vote shares for the Obama, in Wisconsin, for the Obama 2008 election, Feingold 2010, Barrett, Democrat 2010, Barrett in 2012, Burke in 2014. What I'm showing here is that the final vote, the early vote shares are high, and they're dropping down to the final vote, which you can see in orange. So it's the same pattern in all of these elections. Now, finally, the Wisconsin Governor True Vote Model 2014 shows that Burke was the winner by about 51 to 47%. What I do there is I'm getting the returning Obama voters, applying pretty much basic vote shares, assuming equal turnout, and I'm coming up with about 51-47%. I confirm that the actual recorded vote was 46-52, and this number, the cumulative vote shares, I show is 50.2 to 48.7, a little closer.
Richard, is it as simple as counting the votes cast for Burke for Walker and vice versa, or is it done in a more complicated fashion?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I've made the point that the percentages were correct, but they were allocated to the wrong candidates. That Burke should have won by the margin attributed to Walker. And I've observed that one way that result would be accomplished is simply have the votes tabulated for Walker when they're cast for Burke and vice versa.
Well, I don't know about that, they exactly mirror each other. They do appear, it does appear to be the case. In other elections, you'll see it too. Basically, what they're doing is, the voting machine or the central tabulator is flipping Burke to Walker. Okay? So you do have that. Or they might be flipping the third party to Walker. Okay? So there's vote flipping going on.
Well, Why doesn't the public understand that paper ballots hand counted is the only reliable method, and this whole business of having machines do it is to steal elections?
Okay, I got a feeling about that, and I've gotten into some arguments with people about that. Yes, hand counted paper ballots is always preferable, but you still have there are cases where they still rig the hand counted paper ballots. It's harder, but they did that in the 2011 Supreme Court, Wisconsin Supreme Court. They busted the bags which had all the paper ballots, and that was obvious that, you know, that they stuffed the ballots or whatever. So, yes, obviously hand counted paper ballots by three independent arbitrary observers, an excellent, you have to make sure the votes are.
It's cheaper and more reliable and brings communities together in a cooperative effort to implement democratic procedures.
Absolutely. And that's why you only see, in fact, in the we're looking at the breakdown of the 2004 of the voting, the errors in the discrepancies were the worst with the lever machines, especially in New York and Connecticut. They were very bad in the touch screens and the optical scanners, 7%, but in paper ballots, the discrepancies were only 2%. So it's proven that paper ballots are more accurate, counting of paper ballots. They're going to steal. It's much easier to steal votes using machines. There's no question about that. No question. All right, let's go to the next slide. All right, now I just want to introduce a concept here. People criticize my work. They say, oh, there's too much variation. You don't really know what's going on. I mean, you can't predict. You can't say that so many voted for this guy and so many voted for this guy. I said, well, no, you're right. I don't have to say that. So what I do is I take a range of scenarios. And these matrices show various assumptions on the 2014 election for Burke, a share of new voters, Burke's share of returning Obama voters, both against Burke's share of Romney voters. So you have 25 different scenarios, combinations. We're covering the risk. We're covering the margin of error, if you will. And I'm not only calculating the vote shares, I'm calculating the corresponding vote margins. Now you can see that Burke wins all but two scenarios. Okay? She wins, but there's only two red numbers in there where her margin was negative. But she won 48 out of 50, in this case, scenarios went to Burke. Now, another thing to keep in mind is, so that's a very powerful tool, sensitivity analysis. I use it also in the very heavily in JFK mortalities. Same concept. The concept is very simple. Nobody could say exactly what happened, but we can look at a range of possibilities, and we can basically look at the best and worst case and central scenario. The central most likely scenario is in yellow in the middle. Best case is all the way on the right, top. Worst case, bottom left. Okay, then what I'm showing here is the cumulative vote shares, the top 15 counties for Burke. At the 10% mark, she had 55% of the top 15 counties, but in the recorded vote, she ended up with 49%. So they stole the votes in the big top 15 Wisconsin counties. Right, let's go to the next slide. We're getting to the end. Okay. I just recently came up with this voter turnout model which again, none of this stuff is really that difficult. It's just applying a little basic knowledge, common sense. I'm looking at the actual registration statistics. I got that from the U.S., well, the U.S. Census, and a number of states provide that information, the percentage of Democrats, Republicans, Independents. In Wisconsin, we have 43% registered of the total registration of Democrats, 41 Republicans, 16 Independents. In this case, I'm assuming, just to be conservative, because there are a lot of people who say, well, the Democrats don't turn out as much as Republicans. That's not true. I'm giving the Republican here, Walker, a 4% increase in turnout on a percentage basis over Burke. And yet still, based on the percentages that Burke and Walker pull of the Democrats, Republicans, Independents, I assume they split the Independents, Burke is still a winner, even if you assume that more Republicans came out on a percentage basis than Democrats. And we can't make that assumption. But I'm doing it here just to be conservative. In fact, what I'm showing here, again, sensitivity analysis, I'm showing for different turnout, Democratic turnout, what effect it has on Burke's final vote share. And you can see she loses the election in these scenarios and wins them over here. This is the 51-6, which we had in the true vote. All right, we'll go to the next slide. I realize this, people might not be following this totally, but if you look at it, it's really not that tough. I do the same for the Kentucky 2015 governor election.
Chance, next slide.
Now, this is very interesting. Yeah, we've got it here. In Kentucky, people are not aware of a very simple fact. 53% of the voters are Democrats, 38% Republicans. So, even assuming 40% of the Democrats turned out and 46% of the Republicans turned out, Conway is still a winner by 49-47%. Based on very conservative, that he had 88% of Democrats and only 4% of Republicans. And in fact, he lost the independent vote by 42-51%. So what I'm showing here, despite all these advantages we're giving to the Republican Bevin, Conway is still a winner.
All the advantage mathematically, you're saying there's no way in which, given any reasonable set of mathematical assumptions, Conway could have lost.
I'm saying that the odds are very high that he won that election. Yeah. I'm saying, look, you know, the percentages I'm providing there, you know, if I take 1% off of Conway, give it to Bevin, that'll make it tighter. But considering the fact that I'm assuming everything in Bevin's favor, higher turnout of Republicans, a higher turnout, a higher vote share of Democrats than Conway has of Republicans, Conway's still a 49-47% winner. All right, let's go to Massachusetts. This was a very big stolen election. And yet, the Republican won by 2%, 48-46.
Next slide, Chance.
No, it's right here on the bottom.
Oh, I missed it.
Yeah. Registered Democrats, again, you're talking about Massachusetts. This is Kennedy country. Democrats, 35%. Republicans, 11%. Independents, 54%. Okay. I'm saying, okay, 60% Democrats turned out. 86% of Republicans turned out. And still, Coakley won that election by 55-40%. Now, how do you figure this disparity between that and the recorded vote? I'm giving Coakley 91% of Democrats. That's very standard. I'm giving her 9% of Republicans. I'm saying they tied the independent vote. And I'm giving the advantage to the Republican on the turnout. Coakley is still a solid, massive winner. And yet, by 16%, yet she lost by 2%. How do you figure it? Impossible. I can't, I, you know, there's no way that she lost.
Richard, they cheated.
They cheated over and over again. Next slide. Next slide. There you go. Florida, 2012-14. Scott won by 65,000 votes, 1.1% margin. Crist won that election. He won every one of the models. Again, I'm giving a turnout. You have 38.8% Democrats, 35% Republicans. I'm saying 66% Democrats turned out, 71% Republicans. Crist got 91% of Democrats, 10% of Republicans. They tied the independent vote. Crist is a winner by 50 to 46%. Very simple math based on published statistics of the voter split registration.
I think the Democrats are at fault here, Richard. They have analysts and statisticians just like you. They have to know what's going on. I'm never going to give another cent to the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I gave up on them. I gave up on them totally.
It's outrageous.
Yeah. And again, I'm showing here the other models which confirm the true vote, the model. So there you go. Florida is another one. Let's go to the next slide. Illinois. The Republican won by 50 to 46%. But let's once again give the Republican a 6% advantage in turnout of Republicans. There are 47%. The split in Illinois is 47% Democrats, 35% Republicans, 18% independent. Let's give 60% turnout of the Democrats compared to the 68% of the Republicans. Once again, the ubiquitous 91% will give Quinn, the Democrat of the Democratic vote, 7% of the Republican vote. Quinn is the winner, 50 to 47%. Okay, so it's virtually a flip, as you said, from one to the other. But here it's right there in numbers. Anybody want to play with the numbers? Well, they can do the sensitivity analysis. The true vote model shows similar things. That's based on returning Obama-Romney voters. Voter turnout model. And then, of course, the cumulative vote shares. Top 15 counties. Quinn has.
Richard, you have 5 minutes for the last three slides.
Okay. All right, let's go to the next one. We're doing pretty good. All right, Maryland, it's another one. Now, here we talk about massive fraud. Let's see, we got 55% Democrats to 26% Republicans. Democratic turnout, 54% compared to 66% Republicans. The Democrat Brown had 89% of Democrats, only 5% of Republicans. The Democrat Brown was a 56 to 42% winner. Not a 51 to 47% loser. So it's a 18% turnaround. Now, let's look at it another way. We have early votes, early voters, election day voters, and then we have absentee and provisional ballots. On election day, Hogan, the Republican, had 53% of the vote. On the early voters, Democrat had 54%. And of the early voters, and he had 55% of absentee and provisional ballots. What does this tell us? The election is stolen on election day by the voting machines. On election day. It happened with Obama, where we had Romney winning the election day vote, believe it or not, in 2012. Okay, so there you go. There's another way of looking at discrepancy. Now let's go to the next slide. Let's see where we are. Okay, I looked at Senate exit polls. Now, this is very interesting. I just came up with this, and maybe this will probably do it. Why would you expect that the North Carolina, why would there be not available votes for Hispanics, Asians, and others? That's 5%. Why were the votes not – the vote share is not filled in. Okay. So I filled them in. I said, okay, we know the Democrat gets a majority of minority voters. When I put in the set, when I filled in those blanks, there's no reason for them being unavailable. The Democrat's the winner. Similarly, in Alaska, why were there no blacks, Hispanics, and Asians who comprise 14% of the vote? We don't see their votes. When I put them in there, when I put in 94% for Democrat for blacks, 50%, just 50% for Hispanics and Asians, the Democrat is the winner. So there you go. It's another trick they pull. They just won't give you all the votes, vote shares. What could possibly be the rationale for having not available when you have 3% blacks, 5% Hispanics, 6% Asians? They obviously know that they voted, so where the hell are the numbers?
They're getting more and more blatant about their theft of elections, aren't they?
Oh, boy, it's amazing. All right, let's keep going. That's North Carolina, Arkansas, Alaska. Here's Colorado, same thing. What we have is Hispanics, 13%, Asians, and other, total of, and blacks. None of them are available. That's 20% of the vote. All NA. I fill them in, and we find out that the Democrat won. The pattern should be obvious. Next slide.
These are your references.
These are references. I would advise you to consider that mathematicians agree with my analysis on the cumulative vote shares. Beth Clarkson from Kansas, Jeff Webb from Vanderbilt, Francois Choquette and James Johnson did the 2012 primaries. Kathy Dopp, I want to mention her name. She is probably the foremost expert on the mathematics of election auditing. And she wrote a fantastic peer-reviewed article called "With the 2014 Senatorial Gubernatorial Elections Manipulated."
And the answer is an overwhelming yes.
Yeah, and her numbers agree. Her results agree with mine.
Chance, go to the last slide. Richard, I can't thank you enough. I want to recommend everyone. There's a book Richard has that's less intimidating called Matrix of Deceit. You can get it on Amazon.com. I really appreciate your taking the time to join me this evening to discuss all this, Richard. You're a brilliant guy. And I only wish that the public were paying attention, because we have lost democracy to machines, and we ought to be able to regain control of our fate, but we're not going to do anything about it. Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest this hour, Richard Charnin, for being here. Stand by for the new JFK show to follow.
Less than 3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
Say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination.
You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
You're listening to the new JFK show, number 90. All right, here we go. We're going to be taking on Jim DiEugenio, and we're going to address the recent article, The Decline and Fall of Dr. James Fetzer. So we're loaded for bear. We are really ready to expose these ops, and we're not going to be playing around. All right, so Dr. Fetzer.
Well, Gary, we don't want to beg any questions. We want to investigate whether his criticisms are or are not well founded, which depends upon two factors: whether he's using reliable evidence and whether he's committing fallacies. If he's not committing fallacies, if he is using reliable evidence, then he's made a case against me. And on the contrary, if he has not made a case against me because he is not using reliable evidence or is committing fallacies, he's in effect made a case against himself. So we're going to sort this out here today. The first slide reflects that he's got a pretty big target because this guy he's attacking is published on a whole host of subjects. JFK, 9/11, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, the moon landing, the Holocaust. We're going to get into a whole lot of these. Don, why don't you give us an introduction? The next slide takes us to the part one of a two-part series where today we'll address as much of part one as we can and then continue next week.
Okay, yeah. I was made aware of this article last night. I heard DiEugenio talking about it last year, so I knew it was in the pipeline, and I was kind of looking forward to it, and then a few months went by. I completely forgot about the damn thing. And then we got the email yesterday, so I got my butt over to CTKA, and you know I'm a little disappointed in Mr. DiEugenio. I thought he would be able to go after Jim with a little more credibility than what he did. I mean, if I was going to attack Jim Fetzer, I think I could do a better job than this. I really do, because DiEugenio, he kind of gets out of his league here, and we're not going to be able to cover all this tonight, but, you know, he starts to venture out into Sandy Hook territory and 9/11. I mean, areas he hasn't done any research in and knows nothing about. And he hasn't even studied your stuff, Jim. you know, one thing, you know, of all the shills out there, the one I've got respect for probably the most is Wayne Costi. Wayne at least reads our material before he starts attacking us.
And of course you're talking about in 9/11.
Yeah. He doesn't come after us on JFK or anything like that, but he's at least been to my blog and read what I've written and what my positions are, and he's tried to attack them. He doesn't go after me personally, so I'm not gonna, I've got respect for Wayne, you know, on that level where he sticks to, you know, he lays off the personal attacks and he goes after the evidence. Now, he can't refute it, but I mean, nobody could, but he does, he gives it a good go. Anyway.
Let me just make a comment here about the second paragraph. Yeah, he's talking about my first book, Assassination Science, published in 1998. Yep. And he's saying he bought it because it contained two articles by Dr. David Mantyk, whom he considered to be a good authority on the medical evidence. Well, David and I had been collaborating since 1992. He and I were discussing his research before he entered the National Archives for the first time. He made presentation with Dr. Bob Livingston in 1993 in Dallas. But this was the first time Mantyk's work was being published. So, you know, it would seem as though that would be a worthy note here. But in any case, he makes an effort to trivialize the book, and I'll explain why I think that's a very dubious enterprise. Why don't you take us, Don, to the next slide and the very first question? You've done a wonderful job of formulating the issues.
Sure. I thought, well, okay, if we're going to hammer Jim DiEugenio, let's talk about what he actually wrote. So I went through and read the article, and yeah, we'll go down here point by point. So point one here is Assassination Science. So here he's going after your bullet list, and here's a quote from an excerpt from DiEugenio's article. That is proof demonstrating there were more than three bullets fired in Dealey Plaza that day. But the very first pieces of evidence he uses, he misconstrues. Referencing David Lifton's best evidence, he writes that in that book, Lifton shows the reader photos of two, quote, substantial bullet fragments, unquote, and then adds that they were recovered from the presidential limousine and that they thus denote, for his purposes, two bullets. Unfortunately, this is incorrect, and this is rather easily proven so. For if one goes to the Warren Commission exhibits, which picture the two fragments, it is plainly captioned that they are head and tail of one bullet. Since Fetzer lists the commission exhibit numbers, it's odd that he got this wrong. See commission exhibits 567 and 569.
Well, let's go to the page in Assassination Science where I address that in the next slide, number four. And what I say about it is point number one and two, Lifton's best evidence, 1980, page 234. Publishes photographs of two bullet fragments, very substantial fragments that appear to be of two bullets that were removed from the limousine. They were Warren Commission exhibits 567 and 569. The total number of possible bullets given this evidence equals two. Here I'm doing is what I call the argument from addition and subtraction as to how many bullets were fired. And I'm arguing that there was an absolute minimum of eight. But I actually, you know, looked at the fragments as they are in the book, as the next slide shows, number five. And based upon my experience with ammunition, and I used to supervise recruit training, including marksmanship training as a commissioned officer in the Marine Corps, those do not appear to me to be the head and the tail of the same bullet. Those appear to be two bullet fragments. Obviously, David Lifton thought so, too. And what rather strikes me as remarkable is DiEugenio's methodology. He says there's a simple answer to this. Let's just go to the commission and read the caption. And he's taking for granted that the caption that the commission gave for these two fragments, that they were the head and back of the same bullet, is true. Now, my opinion is if that's his method to approach the study of JFK, why not just admit that the Warren Commission declared Lee Oswald was a lone assassin and let it go at that? Indeed, later on, he's faulting me for what he claims to be my failure to go back to the evidence. But I declare it appears to me he has no competence here, that he doesn't know what he's talking about. I don't believe he has any military experience. He's simply taken for granted what he's told by the Warren Commission of all people. Turn to slide number six. Because I've been very interested in how many times JFK was hit. And here we have Thomas Evan Robinson, who was the mortician who prepared the body for a funeral. And that in addition to the large gaping hole in the back of his head, there was a small wound in the right temple, the entrance wound for that large blowout, and a wound on the back 5 to 6 inches below the shoulder, just to the right of the spinal column. A most interesting note here is his final remark in the bullet points, no swelling or discoloration to the face, meaning that he died instantly. If you look at slide number 7, this is my surmise of the number of times that JFK was hit, because he was hit in the back by a shot fired from the top of the county records building, about 5.5 inches below the collar and just to the right of the spinal column. He was hit once in the throat by a shot that actually passed through the windshield. And then after William Greer, the driver, pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt, he was hit at least twice in the head. Once in the back of the head, he slumped forward. Jackie eased him back and was looking him right in the face. Here in the next slide, number 8, we have something approximating the total number, including the missed shots, because we had, in fact, a dent in the chrome strip, which was actually shown in the upper right-hand corner of an earlier slide. We had a shot that was pulled up out of the grass by a lieutenant, and we have a shot that missed an injured James Tague. Plus, we know there was many as 3 shots to Connally. So you got 4 hits on JFK. David thinks there may yet have been one more shot to his head. But a minimum of 4, 3 misses, that's 7, and then 1 to 3 hitting Connally, that's 8, 9, or 10 shots. I don't see where Di Eugenio, whether he quibbles about, you know, the whether that's 2 fragments or the same bullet or not, has any ground to dispute the more important point. And just to make a few additional remarks about the book, slide number 9 shows David not only demonstrated that the autopsy x-ray had been altered by patching the rear area that's very, very bright, but that there was a distribution of bullets, small metal fragments that were indicative of a second shot to the head, where the larger fragments carry further forward. So he not only determined that there was alteration to conceal a massive blowout to the back of the head, but that there had been a second shot to the head in addition to the one ascribed by the Bethesda physicians at the vicinity of the external occipital protuberance, which had in fact entered the right temple, where its exit was what they were seeking to obfuscate by altering the x-rays. And then in slide number 10, we find we have a wonderful, sensational statement from Robert B. Livingston, MD, a world authority on the human brain, an expert on wound ballistic, who studied the reports of cerebral and cerebellar damage from Parkland and concluded that the brain shown in the diagrams and photographs at the National Archives cannot possibly be that of JFK, in part because it shows a completely intact cerebellum at the base of the head. And if you turn to slide number 11, you'll see the reports he was talking about. One physician after another reported extruding cerebellar as well as cerebral tissue, and that's utterly inconsistent with the diagrams and photographs found in the National Archives. Slide number 12 shows you the relative location of the cerebellum in relation to the cerebrum. So when I put this together, I sought to explain everything that you would need to know to appreciate what was going on here. And many appendices, including the official Bethesda autopsy report, and in slide number 13, you'll find I had a wonderful appendix from Charles Crenshaw where I asked him to draw the JFK wounds, and he drew both a throat wound, a small puncture wound with a straight incision before and after, and then this view of the back of the head wound, the size of your fist when you double it up, and from the side. So how Di Eugenio can think he can denigrate assassination science is beyond me. He ignores most of the important evidence contained therein, and it seems to me he's simply incompetent when it comes to the medical evidence and doesn't have any idea of the importance of this. He knows David Mantic's name, but that seems to be the extent of it. Embarrassing.
Okay, so yeah, from my point of view, the takeaway there is that the Warren Commission got it right and Fetzer got it wrong. I think that would, I mean, if you were to just sum up Di Eugenio's little blast there in a nutshell, I think one could reasonably conclude that.
That's right. But look, it's not just me. Charles Crenshaw, Bob Livingston, David Manning. There's a a mountain of evidence there. Vincent Bugliosi, by the way, no proponent of conspiracy, acknowledged that Mind World, the only three exclusively scientific books ever published on the assassination of JFK.
Yep.
And let's go to point number two, Don.
Let's go to two. Yep. Okay. So Secret Service complicity. And here we get back to D'Eugenio here. Quote, then Fetzer's scientific reasoning veers off even more. He writes that the probability in favor of the Secret Service setting up Kennedy are anywhere from a million to one to a billion to one, see page 367. Quite naturally, he then concludes that the evidence of the Secret Service setup of President Kennedy is overwhelming. He uses the usual litany of complaints here, e.g. someone wiped out the back of the limousine outside of Parkland Hospital. My question, did Fetzer ever try and find the man who used a bucket to wipe out the back of the limousine? To my knowledge, he remains nameless to this day. Therefore, there is no interview with him to see why he did what he did, or if he did do it of his own volition or someone told him to do so. If these factors are not known, then how can one assign a mathematical probability to them happening?
Well, this is very embarrassing, Don. What I was doing was enumerating a whole series of actions by the Secret Service that looked incredible in the sense that they should not happen even once on any occasion. I assigned them the stunning improbability of one in 10, as though they would happen one time in 10, when actually they shouldn't happen one time in 1,000. Let's look at some of those, because it's very simple if you add them up. If you have 1 in 10 and another 1 in 10, that's 1 in 100 that the two should happen by chance 3. 1 in 1,000 they should happen by chance, and there's 17. That means if you look at those 17, there's 1 over a 1 followed by 17 zeros. And I don't know how D'Eugenio could possibly dispute the mathematics here, because they're as elementary as they could possibly be. Just to review some of the bidding here. The next slide, 15, shows two agents were left behind at Love Field by Emery Roberts. These were the guys that should have run along beside the limousine or ridden on the back. Does he think that was standard procedure and should have happened?
Nothing nefarious there, Jim.
Nothing nefarious there. Number 16. The limousines the motorcycle escort was reduced to 4 who were instructed not to ride forward of the rear wheels. One of them said it was the damnedest formation he'd ever seen. JFK's military aide, who normally sat between the driver and the agent in charge, was moved to the last vehicle along with the president's personal physician. They had to do that because they knew they were going to fire a shot through the windshield. If the aide had been there, it would have hit him instead of JFK. Here's another. Look at slide 17. They didn't cover the open windows. They didn't seal the manhole covers. I mean, look at this. The crowd was being allowed to spill out into the seat. Does anyone think that's appropriate procedure for protecting the president of the United States? Look at number 18. This is perhaps the single most appalling photograph from the entire motorcade, because an assassin in the bus with a hand weapon, with a .45, could have assassinated JFK on the spot. And look how the complete absence of crowd control, where the 112th Military Intelligence Unit was ordered to stand down. I mean, when it comes to presidential protection, this is an obscenity. Look at number 19. A motorcade route was changed just 4 days before the event on the 18th. Normally, they fix a motorcade route and they never change it, because the Secret Service has to check every building and screen its occupants. How often should that have happened? Not 1 in 10. Never. Absolutely never. Look at the next, number 20.
Oh, and then they publish it in the paper, too.
That was deliberately done so they could claim that the public knew, so that the man they were going to tag as the patsy would have had information. Most telling of all, the vehicles were in an improper sequence. The presidential limousine was placed first. Lower-ranking dignitaries, such as the mayor and the vice president, should have preceded him. Reporters were moved to the rear. The president's personal physician in the last car, putting him in the worst position should his patient require emergency medical treatment. This is truly stunning. And, of course, in addition, the flatbed truck that would have carried the reporters covering the event was also canceled at the last minute. And now 21, we come to the point about which Di Eugenio asks, at Parkland, where the moribund president was taken, a Secret Service agent took a bucket and sponge and began cleaning up the blood and brains from the limousine. When onlookers noticed a through and through hole in the windshield, the vehicle was moved. Does he think, is it his imagination that, and you can see the bucket in the photograph, that an agent should have taken a bucket and sponge to wash blood out of a limousine? That was a crime scene on wheels. Notice how he tries to divert attention to the identity of the man who did it. Interestingly, about 2 years ago, I was approached by a man who claimed to have been a personal friend of Sam McKinney and owned the Secret Service Cadillac. He told me that Sam McKinney had claimed to have got the bucket and sponge to wash the blood and brains out. Now, others have told me when I floated that hypothesis that if this was the person who was doing it, and actually I think he's bent over to the left of the cop in the uniform, that looks more like Kellerman. He looked too tall, but the man actually doing it bent over. So I may even have an answer to that question. It may have been Sam Kinney. But what is Di Eugenio distracting from the fact that we have a minimum of 17 indications of Secret Service complicity? And even if we assign each of those events the astoundingly high probability of one time in 10, we get 1/1 to the 17 zeros. I mean, that's a powerful result. And to my knowledge, no one had made that specific argument before based upon the indication of Secret Service complicity. Moreover, Gary, I think we have, you know, Nigel Turner was sufficiently impressed with what I had to say with it, about this, that he actually put it in to episode number 6, The Smoking Guns of the Men Who Killed Kennedy, which if chance can play, we can even play at this point in time.
Why? Uniquely on that day in Dallas, the press, the camera crews, Kennedy's military aide, who would normally sit in the front of the president's car, and even his personal physician, were all relegated to the rear of the motorcade by the Secret Service.
In a conventional motorcade, the president would be somewhere in the middle, surrounded by security and the press. In this case, the presidential limousine was set right out in front of every other limousine, which, of course, is the reason why the Secret Service destroyed the records of its own motorcades when they were asked for them by the Assassination Records Review Board.
The most suspicious behavior by shift leader Emory Roberts was to be at the time of the shooting in Dealey Plaza.
Tragically, he actually ordered the agents not to move during the heart of the shooting. Agent Sam Kinney, who drove the FOB car, admitted as much to me and told me, quote, exactly right, end quote. And all these deficiencies begin and end with the Secret Service, because they were the prime movers. They were the ones who were directing the security arrangements from Washington up to and including in the heart of Dallas during security meetings. They were the ones that gave out assignments, vetoed or approved of security arrangements, so the buck stops with them.
At Parkland Hospital after the president's death, the media were reporting that the fatal shots had come from in front of the presidential car.
A press conference was conducted by Acting Press Secretary Malcolm Kilduff at 1:30 after the president had been pronounced dead at 1 o'clock. Malcolm Kilduff explained that it had been a simple matter of a bullet right through the head while pointing to his right temple, and attributing that finding to Admiral George Berkeley, who was the president's personal physician. This wound to the right temple and another wound to the throat, three different times described as a wound of entry, were widely broadcast on radio and television that afternoon. They were quickly suppressed because, of course, they contradicted the official government account, which was that three shots had been fired, all of them.
Don, I'm struck that, you know, Jim Di Eugenio wants to trivialize the arguments I've made, but Nigel Turner, who many regard as knowing something about the subject, thought what I was having to report about Secret Service complicity was worthy enough to incorporate into The Men Who Killed Kennedy.
Yeah, okay, so with point two here, you know, before we go to three, we'll just sum up. The gist of it is here is there was no Secret Service complicity.
Well, I just wanted to add to all those wonderful points that Jim just made, that Secret Service complicity, he also should have included William Greer pulling the limousine to a complete stop so that JFK could receive the coup de grace. and also Sam Kinney, who found Commission Exhibit 399, also known as the Magic Bullet, and he later on planted it on the stretcher. And this is ongoing research that Jim has done post assassination science. So you know, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, it would come as news to me, Larry, if the last work I did on JFK was published in 1998, but maybe that's Jim DiEugenio's opinion. Tell us about point number three, Don.
Okay, so let's, so to sum it up, and Fletcher Prouty, how many interviews have you seen with Fletcher Prouty talking about Secret Service complicity? And, anyway, there, so we'll, so obviously the Secret Service was in on it. Let's face facts. Okay, so point number three, this takes us to Chauncey Holt, or Chauncey Marvin Holt, as he's sometimes referred to. And here's DiEugenio again, quote, he now states that his witness Chauncey Holt reported in a radio interview that he was a counterfeiter who worked for the CIA in 1963, Ibid, page 368. He was ordered to bring false Secret Service identifications to Dealey Plaza on 11-22-63. That he disguised himself as one of the three tramps in the famous photographs of these hobos who, after being unloaded from a train car, were escorted through Dealey Plaza on the way to the police headquarters. If we added up all the researchers who have made claims about who these three tramps were, the number would probably be in double figures. To say on the basis of a radio interview that we know who they are and that Holt is credible, what is scientific about that deduction? What is even forensic about it? Suffice it to say, other researchers have dug into Holt's story at great length and have shown great doubt about his claims. For instance, that Holt traveled to New Orleans to deliver pre-printed leaflets to Guy Bannister's office for Oswald to pass out. When in fact, there is evidence that these were printed in New Orleans and Oswald hand-stamped the leaflets with Bannister's address.
Well, this is very embarrassing, as though that were the sole. I met Chauncey Holt. I sent him a copy of a 3.5-hour production I did on JFK, the assassination, the cover-up, and beyond in 1994. He called me up in the middle of the morning about 3:30 to tell me he'd been up all night watching it. He thought I had it right. I flew to California and met him in a restaurant at the Rose Bowl. I have subsequently read several manuscripts he wrote. I invited his daughter, Karen, to come to a Dallas conference. I believe I was co-chairing at the time where we had a symposium. She took photos from the family album and presented them and imposed them over Chauncey's face. I know a lot about Chauncey. I'm unable to report all here and now. But even Jerry Rose, who is the editor of the third decade and then the fourth decade, rose at the end to say that while he had always believed that the third tramp was E. Howard Hunt, he had now been convinced that, in fact, it was Chauncey Holt and wanted everyone to understand. Some would suggest that Jerry Rose might know even as much as Jim DiEugenio about these issues. But yeah, Jerry was there, and DiEugenio was not. And it's appalling to me that he makes these statements based on absolute ignorance. He knows nothing about me and my relationship with Chauncey Holt. Let's look at a couple of the photographs we're talking about. Number 23. Where Chauncey was the third, he described to me the paper bag. He told me what he had in it. It was a special communication system and a special gun that the police were interested in the gun. None of these guys is dressed as hobos. Here's another photograph, 24, especially important because we have identification from no less authority than General Victor Krulak of the Marine Corps and L. Fletcher Prouty the general who, Edward Lansdale, who supervises assassinations all over the world and whose fingerprints are on the Dealey Plaza assassination. Many of us believe that it was Lansdale who positioned the shooters and determined the sequence of shots. In slide number 25, we see the photograph where I believe I was the first to recognize that figure at the top left was George Herbert Walker Bush. When I was looking at a series of photographs in the Chief Curry's JFK assassination file, which he published when he became head of security for 7-Eleven stores. It was only available in a paperback edition. And then we have another photograph from the plaza where Lansdale's waiting to speak to Bush. Here we have a chapter of an appendix of the book, The Man on the Grassy Knoll, reporting the analysis of Lois Gibson, who is a forensic artist for the Houston Police Department. I invariably talk about Lois's identification of the three parties here. You can go to the next slide, too, Chance, because she identified them as Charles Rogers, as Charles Harrelson, and go again to number 28. And the third as Chauncey Holt. And if you go to 29, she had an advantage in dealing with Chauncey because he actually came into her office and she had him present physically in order to make the determination. And the fact is that she's a celebrated forensic artist with many accomplishments to her name. D'Eugenio is either massively ignorant or simply dissembling. He appears to have done no research on the subject, doesn't know anything about it, but that, it appears, is his practice.
So, yeah, so the takeaway there is that, you know, D'Eugenio likes to implicate the CIA in the operation, and yet when we have a bona fide CIA individual, he throws cold water all over it.
Chauncey was working at the Los Angeles Stamp and Stationery Store as a contract agent for the CIA. He was a forger, a counterfeiter, a painter. He was directed by his handler, Philip Twombly, to prepare 15 sets of Ford Secret Service credentials for use in and around Dealey Plaza. He was worried about getting the color-coded pins in time, but he did. He went there. The red truck, he was supposed to leave them parked in the lot behind the grassy knoll used by the Dallas Police Department, was not present. He wandered around Dealey Plaza. He told me so. More bad guys, killers and mercenaries than you'd find at a Soldiers of Fortune convention. There's more to say about it, but I'm telling you, Jim D'Eugenio knows not only nothing about Chauncey Holt, but nothing about my knowledge and familiarity with Chauncey and the evidence that substantiates his story.
Jim, I also wanted to add to that that Chauncey Holt is captured in on film next to Lee Harvey Oswald while he's passing out leaflets in front of the Trademark in downtown New Orleans. So Chauncey Holt had been in New Orleans, and he was part of the whole operation there along with Lee Oswald.
Yeah, well, that's not going to impress Jim D'Eugenio because he claims to be the authority about New Orleans and everything related to the assassination there, too.
Yeah, don't forget that Ed Haslam's writing a book on Chauncey Holt, and I talked to him in New Orleans, and he said that Chauncey Holt's the real deal. So
that's certainly my conclusion, too, but apparently not that of Jim D'Eugenio. Let us continue. The next slide.
Okay, now here's another one that gets the ire up of D'Eugenio and some of these other people, Len Osanek and certainly Doug Campbell and Rob Clark. So Madeline Duncan Brown. Okay, so topic four here and from D'Eugenio's article, quote, from here, Fetzer's book gets even worse. He starts writing about Madeline Brown and the infamous Murchison Party. Like the three tramps, this party has become a matter of evolution. Except in this case, it's not the identities that have evolved. It's the sheer number of persons reported present. Fetzer goes in all the way on this one. He has George Brown of Brown and Root, J. Edgar Hoover, John McCloy, Richard Nixon, and LBJ all on hand, page 369. When LBJ arrived, there was a closed-door private meeting of about 20 minutes in length. When it was over, Johnson told Madeline that Kennedy would be taken down. To go through all the problems with this rather tardy night before planning, and the credibility of Ms. Brown would be both laborious and cruel. Suffice it to say, Seamus Coogan has done some nice work on this Murchison gathering and found some good reasons to qualify it as suspect.
Anyone who would cite Seamus Coogan as an expert on anything related to JFK is a total moron. The
yes.
guy's a contrivance. He's a phony fictional character and a very nasty piece of work. Let's look at slide number 31. Yep.
Before we go into that, I just want to say real quick, I'll turn you loose here, Jim. Okay, this was not a planning the whole operation meeting, 20 minutes long, obviously not. Okay, I don't know if Jim D'Eugenio's ever done any projects, but I'm an IT guy. Okay, when there's a major project underway, before they go live with it, there's several milestone meetings, and like the night before or maybe even a couple days before the major project goes live, the heavy hitters will go into a boardroom for about 20 minutes or a half hour, and they make a call. Hey, is it go or no go? And that's what this meeting was here. Hey, are we going or not? You know, if we don't, cause, you know, like they had a no go in Miami. They had a no go in Chicago. They could have had a no go here and then they wouldn't have kicked off their whole propaganda apparatus, but it was obviously it was an up or down decision and they decided to go.
Don, you're exactly right. It was the ratification meeting because of Madeline's relationship with Lyndon, where they began an affair in 1948. She bore him a son, Stephen, got his only child out of wedlock in 1950. She was invited to these events. It was a relatively small meeting, about three dozen people, but some heavy hitters. J. Edgar Hoover was there. She thought it was in his honor. George Brown, Brown and Root Heavy Construction was there. When the Vietnam War went down, the Brown and Root was given $1 billion to dredge a new port at Cam Ranh Bay, though I'm quite sure that it wasn't actually needed because Vietnam has many magnificent natural ports. So remember, Richard Nixon was there. He was driven out by a local Republican leader, worked in the same bank building where she was a young advertising executive. That John J. McCloy was there is particularly fascinating since he was our former high commissioner to Germany, former CIA to Chase Manhattan Bank, and was representing the Eastern establishment. When Lyndon Johnson organized the Warren Commission, there were two members of the House, two members of the Senate, and two so-called civilians. One of them was Alan Dulles, who undoubtedly had a key role in arranging all of this, and the other was John J. McCloy, who was supposed to be an independent but actually participated in the ratification meeting. When Lyndon showed up late in the evening, unexpectedly to most, the heavy hitters disappeared into a boardroom for about 20 minutes. When it broke up, she strode over to Madeline and told her she thought she was expecting him to whisper sweet nothings. Instead, he told her in a hateful tone of voice that after tomorrow, he's not going to be embarrassed by those Kennedy boys any longer. That's not a threat. That's a promise. They had a rendezvous at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas, 6 weeks later on New Year's Eve, where she confronted Lyndon with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved since no one stood to gain more personally. Lyndon blew up at her and told her the CIA and the oil boys had decided that Jack had to be taken out. I believe this attack on Madeline is a covert way of attempting to discredit Lyndon's crucial role in the assassination. Madeline published a book about it entitled Texas in the Morning. Connie Kritzberger and she wrote a book called Dallas Did It that, to my knowledge, was never published. But Connie has reported having read an article about the social event at the Murchisons in the newspaper that was subsequently deleted. She was very upset when a story of hers about the Parkland press conference was altered by her editor at the request of the FBI. But others who have fingered Lyndon Johnson go, look at slide 32. Noel Twyman in his magnificent book, Bloody Treason. Go to slide number 33, where Noel figured out that the most perfect combination with the greatest probability of success was to combine the CIA military with the Secret Service, the Mafia, Lyndon Johnson, and Hoover. Lyndon's involvement was essential because he would become president. He was the only one who could guarantee the subsequent course of events, where there was a determination that no one who had anything to do with the assassination would ever be prosecuted for the crime. But Madeline's story has been substantiated by others. Look, slide number 34. Billy Saul Estes wrote a whole book about it. He knew Cliff Carter. He knew Malcolm Mack Wallace, Lyndon's personal hitman, who murdered a dozen people for Lyndon, including one of his own sisters. They had conversations before and after the assassination. Lyndon actually sent Cliff Carter down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. Billy Saul was convinced that they had both been involved, and Mack appears to have been the shooter in the book depository, firing at John Connally in the mistaken belief that it was the liberal Texas senator. LBJ tried to get out of the vehicle, into the vehicle to replace Ralph Yarborough, to get into the vehicle to replace Connally, but Jack overrode him on the ground that the chief executive of the state should ride with the chief executive of the United States. We get more from Barr McClellan, slide number 35, who talked about his work with the most powerful attorney in Texas and how arrangements were made for the assassination and the cover-up while he was there. Another, believe it or not, is 36, slide number 36, E. Howard Hunt himself, who gave a deathbed confession to his son, St. John, explaining he'd been on the back bench at Dallas, but that the chain of command had gone from Lyndon John to Cordmeyer to David Attlee Phillips to William Harvey to David Sanchez Morales and then down to the mechanics, the shooters on the ground, their coordinators and supervisors. Even, as slide 37 shows, Jack Ruby, who had coincidentally been an investigator for Richard Nixon when Nixon was a member of the House Select Committee on Un-American Activities, explained to reporters when he was in custody after having shot Lee Oswald that it was the man at the top who was responsible. He tried to get Earl Warren to take him back to Washington. And the reporters said, "Are you talking about the guy at the top now?" And he said, "Yes." He even said that if someone else had been vice president, such as Adlai Stevenson, this would never have happened. The masterpiece of all this is slide number 38, the LBJ mastermind of the JFK assassination by Phil Nelson. Once you read a few chapters of this, you'll be blown away and understand completely how Lyndon's character made it virtually inevitable that he would brook no opposition, totally unscrupulous. He'd take any step necessary to become president of the United States, including even removing his predecessor by violence. Indeed, when Lyndon accepted running with Jack in 1960 in Los Angeles, one of his most prominent backers burst into the Johnson suite, enraged that this was happening. Bobby Baker took him into the next room, explained what they had in mind. He came out all smiles. Bobby would later be quoted as saying JFK would not live out his term and that he would die a violent death. He knew because that was their plan. More recently, as slide 39 shows, Roger Stone, who's a very prominent Republican operator who's advised five different presidents, has published The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, a wonderful book, especially because of his background. And as slide 40 shows, even Craig Zirbel had it right in the Texas Connection, where this photograph appeared on the back. And incidentally, isn't it remarkable that Nigel Turner, once again, supported Madeline's story and featured her as a key figure in the final episode of The Men Who Killed Kennedy, which is entitled The Guilty Men, where based on his own research, he'd not only turned up the chef who had cooked the hors d'oeuvres, but the chauffeur who had driven J. Edgar Hoover to the event at the Murchison party. Now, I must say, I even gave an interview of Madeline Duncan Brown in Dallas for one of the Lancer conferences. It was recorded. You can find it online. I had over 100 conversations with Madeline Duncan Brown. I'll just assure you that neither Seamus Coogan nor Jim DiEugenio has a clue when it comes to Madeline Duncan Brown. And it appears they're attempting to obfuscate the evidence that implicates Lyndon Johnson in the assassination of our 35th president.
And not to, forget, Lyndon Johnson was Jewish. Okay, he was a crypto Jew, so he wasn't, openly, a practicing Jew. But within a month of him taking office, one of the first acts he did, he was dedicating a synagogue, I believe somewhere in Texas. Was it in Dallas or Houston? I'd have to go look that up. But he was, within 3 to 4 weeks after the assassination, he was dedicating a brand new synagogue. And he had been heralded by the Jewish community for, smuggling Jews out of Germany. We don't have a specific point on it, but, Johnson was knee deep in the USS Liberty attack, where Israeli planes were shooting up our spy ship. And the goal of that whole operation was to sink the ship, blame it on Egypt, and then nuke Cairo. Yeah. Yeah.
Jim, I also wanted to add that Nigel Turner also interviewed that seamstress woman who had been employed by the Murchisons for decades, and she also confirmed and verified that the Murchison party the night before of the assassination.
Well, I think there's a pattern emerging here that some of the most important discoveries about who was responsible and why JFK was taken out are being targeted by attacking me in an effort to discredit voluminous research by many different sources. I mean, how many books, how many contributors, how many scholars have I mentioned already? And here, Don, we now turn to Murder in Dealey Plaza, and it's remarkable what he has to say.
Yeah, not a ton on this one. I just kind of...
No, I've taken care of it, Don. Just read number five.
Yeah, point number five. Yeah, Murder in Dealey Plaza, quote. Okay, this is Fetzer's high point of JFK research because he contributed little to the book. It's mostly Mantic and Aguilar.
Well, let me just respond to that. It would appear that D. Eugenio would be most impressed with my research on JFK if I'd done none of it. Just read from the back cover what others have felt about this book. A rich and fascinating collection and darkly compelling revelations demonstrate beyond any doubt the existence of conspiracy and cover-up behind the JFK assassination. Michael Parenti.
And Michael Parenti was one of my absolute first heroes in all this stuff. He's kind of the guy that got me down this path back in 91 or so.
No jury would have convicted Lee Harvey Oswald in the face of the argument set forth in this excellent volume. Murder in Dealey Plaza masterfully exposes the fallacies of the Warren Commission report through objective, incontrovertible medical, scientific, and investigative analyses of both old and new evidence. The conclusions are as solid as the credentials and research experience of the contributing authors. It is time that the truth in the JFK assassination be revealed and that United States history be rewritten. Cyril Wecht, MD, JD, past president, American Academy of Forensic Sciences. Maybe D. Eugenio wants to impugn the credentials of Cyril Wecht. Here's another. Murder in Dealey Plaza is a deeply disturbing book which documents the deceit and deception that marked the government's handling of the evidence in the Kennedy assassination. The authors, all highly skilled professionals, describe the cover-up from the falsification of the autopsy results to the alteration of the Zapruder film. Anyone who reads this work will be appalled by the systematic distortion of the truth that JFK died as a result of a conspiracy by certain officials of the U.S. government. Michael Kurtz, author of Crime of the Century. Fetzer and his team of experts uncover so many smoking guns, it's impossible not to spot the fire that the Warren Commission and Gerald Posner have tried hard to deny. A thought-provoking and disturbingly compelling sequel to Assassination Science, Kerry Walters, Gettysburg College. Fetzer has assembled tense, suspenseful essays on our government's perfidious efforts to conceal a conspiracy behind the assassination of President Kennedy. Two brains examined, photographs missing, x-ray altered, notes and reports burned, drawings fabricated. The account of JFK's autopsy is more shocking than the story of Jekyll and Hale and Hyde. Stuart Gallinor, author of Cover Up. You would think from Diogenes' point of view that this book just sprang into existence magically all by itself. I created that book out of whole cloth. I mean, it's outrageous. And look at slide number 42. It was reviewed, Murder in 42 Chance. Chance.
Well, a book that is also used at the college level to teach courses on the JFK assassination, Jim.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And look at this, George Costello writing for the American Lawyer, formerly the Bar and Grill. This is a publication for attorneys who practice before the government. Did a massive review, masterful. He actually received an award for writing this review, the conclusion of which is as follows. What does all of this mean? Any one of the findings summarized above would be troubling by itself. Together, these findings form a critical mass of evidence indicating that President Kennedy's autopsy was falsified and help establish a compelling case of people within the federal government covered up evidence of frontal shots and hints of multiple gunmen in conspiracy in the assassination of President Kennedy. Because it pulls this evidence together in one place, Murder in Dealey Plaza is one of the most important books to date on the Kennedy assassination. The new evidence turns the tables. No longer can defenders of the lone assassination theory hide behind the autopsy evidence and claim that it trumps all the other evidence. The weight of this other evidence now trumps the autopsy report. Lone assassin theorists must address and explain the new evidence if they wish to regain credibility. It is time for people of integrity who are involved in the official investigation, especially the professionals, to take a good faith look at the new evidence and confront the likelihood that their conclusions were based on falsified data. murder in Dealey Plaza may not be the last word on the medical evidence, but it should be the starting place for a fresh look, not only at the medical evidence, but also at the assassination and its implications. There are, by the way, a wonderful chapters by, actually two by Vince Palomara, two by Doug Horn, a brilliant article on the limousine and the windshield shot by Douglas Weldon. I mean, it's just stunning that this man, Di Eugenio, would trivialize the contents of this important book. Look at slide number 43. He wants to talk about Gary Aguilar. Well, Aguilar has a chapter that is decent that traces the reports of the Bethesda physician and claims that they were the same at Parkland as the Parkland physician. So he's trying to minimize any differences, which we now know because of Doug Horn's fantastic work in relation to the ARRB James Humes actually took a cranial saw to the skull of JFK's head and greatly enlarged the wound. But what I find fascinating about this is while he's endorsing Gary Aguilar's work, he seems not to understand that this massive blowout at the back of the head is evidence that the Zapruder film has been altered as frame number 44 reveals, because it was systematically blacked out as it was here. And indeed, Aguilar seems to stop with Bethesda, because look at 45. Slide number 45 shows what the House Select Committee did. They not only patched up the fist-sized hole at the back of the head, they ignore the huge, enormous, gaping wound that had been created by the cranial saw. Look at frame number 46, and you just begin to appreciate the appalling inadequacy of the HSCA, because their depiction of the wound is not even consistent with a Harper fragment. There is no massive blowout at the back of the head for that Harper fragment to fit. And as slide 47 reflects, we have here three different versions. We have the Parkland observation, Bethesda, much larger, which we now understand because of Doug Horn, and the HSCA. Gary Aguilar might have been more workmanlike if he had covered these major discrepancies. He seeks to present the view that Parkland observation were the same as those at Bethesda, which may have been true before Humes took the cranial saw to the head, which was exposed by Thomas Evan Robinson when he gave a deposition to the ARRB. This is fairly stunning stuff. And I still find it ironic that Tink Thompson, who trashed murder in Dealey Plaza, claiming the only essay worth reading was that by Gary Aguilar, seemed not to understand that if Aguilar were correct, then the Zapruder film had to have been altered, because Thompson wants to not only praise Aguilar, but defend the authenticity of the film, which Aguilar's study by itself, as far as it went, although limited, nevertheless disproved and refuted by itself.
All right.
Yeah, I was going to say, next up we'll discuss the Z film, but we've only got a few minutes left here.
A whole half hour just for that.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. I don't know. Any comments you want to weigh in with, Larry, on this thing?
No, I think that Jim has been more than adequate here. I mean, the credentials of the authors of Murder in Dealey Plaza speak for themselves. I mean, just and not only that, the work that Douglas Horn has done after Murder in Dealey Plaza, with his five volume work on the ARRB, and his interviews with Dino Brugioni, and most recently the entire body of work that he has continued to do is just incredible, you know, and just continues to pile on to verify that the Zapruder film has been extensively altered. And is something that, like I said, is going to take more than 5 minutes that we were left, the time that we're left with here. So,
no, this is a good juncture. Don, what would you like to say?
Okay, I've been listening to Rob Clark and Black Op Radio lately, and apparently, I think about a year ago, or maybe it was the end of last year, Jim, you might have been on some guy's show that used to be on American Freedom Radio, and he was pissing and moaning about, boy, Fetzer just talks a lot, and there's all these gunshots, he's got some wacko theory, and weren't there eyewitness reports that it sounded like automatic gunfire? So what
another of the reporters who gave that report. Rapid succession, I think. That it wasn't, in fact, automatic weapon, but I think their plan was to have three salvos of at least three shots, and that some of them were not quite properly timed, so it came across sounding almost like automatic fire.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It was different gun, but the takeaway there is there was a lot of shots, and
there were a lot of silenced shots with silenced weapons also.
Yeah, I believe the only unsilenced weapon was a Mannlicher Carcano used by Mr. Tony Escadro from the Dow Techs, which was done with a Mannlicher Carcano to create the acoustical impression of only three shots having been fired, where all the other shots were silenced. But there's no way of getting around 8, 9, or 10 shots having been fired.
And, you know, I'm just going to throw this out there now. And my thesis on Di Eugenio is that he's been trying to – his real goal is to modernize and freshen up the Warren Report. While seemingly attacking it, he's trying to extend its life into the 2015, 2016, 2017 time frame. You know, I don't know how much longer he's going to be on the scene. Hopefully not much longer after we finish, you know, impugning him here. But I think that's really what their goal is. When you listen to these guys, they attack Fetzer vociferously, and then they even come out and they pull a Judy Wood, and they use the verb Fetzering. You know, I've noticed when Jim really gets somebody, you know, like one of these shills, when he gets them really pissed off, they start talking about Fetzering.
Yeah, but let me just comment on that. Judy Wood introduced this phrase. Yeah. It's about somebody who says a great deal but has nothing to support it. Anyone who knows my work understands I'm precisely the opposite. I always have support. I do my homework. I cannot have taught logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning for 35 years, not know how to do my homework. The new book on Boston is my 32nd book. The three books on JFK broke the medical cover-up, where the very first, Assassination Science, was the most important in that regard. The other cemented it. And, of course, the third, the Great Zapruder Film Hoax, which we'll address next week here because we'll pick up his complaints about the Zapruder film and its authenticity, which would appear he still wants to maintain, have all fallen by the board because of research, including from people like you. Because, you see, I've always known my own limitations. I've always known what I did not know as much as what I did, which is why from the beginning I reached out to others with special competence. Manik has a PhD in physics and MD and is board qualified in radiation oncology, so he knows x-rays inside and out. Bob Livingston, world authority on the human brain, expert on wound ballistics. Charles Crenshaw was in trauma room number one, and then 2 days later responsible for the care and treatment of the alleged assassin, Jack White, legendary photo and film analyst, John P. Costella, another PhD, this time in electromagnetism, the properties of light and of images of moving objects. It's because I bring in experts in different fields, and I've done that again and again and again. I did that in JFK. I did it in 9/11. I've done it with Sandy Hook. I've done it with the Boston bombing. I bring together the best people on these subjects so that all of their expertise can count. And let me say this about the bottom line here. Di Eugenio is going way out of his way to make the case that I'm some kind of fraud, even a disinformation agent. I will agree to this extent. One of us is a fraud and a disinformation agent. And if, after listening to what we have to present, my rebuttal to his arguments, you shouldn't have a tough time figuring out who is who.
All right. Stay tuned for part two next week. We're going to rout out all the shills. This is Don Fox, Jim Fetzer, Larry Rivera, Gary King, and Chance George. We'll see you next week.